Welcome to the AFMAN podcast with myself, Stephen Goldstein, and my co-host, Mark Randall. The AFMAN podcast seeks to illuminate and explore how traders succeed in financial markets by understanding the mindset, behavior, and psychology that underlies great risk-taking performance.
My argument is that personality writes your autobiography. It doesn't plan your day for you.
Welcome to another AFMAN podcast episode with myself, Stephen Goldstein, and my co-host, Mark Randall. That short clip you just heard then was taken from today's episode from our guest, Jeff Trickey, who is here to talk about risk personality. Now, why does risk personality matter? Risk personality is a huge deal, but it is rarely discussed in the world of trading and investment. It is, for me, one of the key traits of the best traders, how they know themselves, how they understand themselves, and how they work in ways which are congruent to their risk personality. This means that they can go to places where, in taking risk, they are at their strongest. They work in ways where their character and personality provide an edge, and they are able to stay away from situations where they have no edge. They do not play where their odds of success are no more than 50-50. Those aren't odds that they want to accept. Thus, they deliberately avoid situations where their personality is not an advantage or where it's a disadvantage. And if you know your personality and you understand it, then you are better able to do that. Now, our guest today is Jeff Trickey. Jeff is one of the world's leading experts on risk personality. Jeff is a psychologist who specializes in the field of psychometric assessments. His company, Psychological Consultancy Limited, has been providing and creating world-leading personality tests for almost three decades. I first came across Jeff nearly a decade ago when I was migrating from being a professional trader to becoming a performance and executive coach. Back then, Jeff and his team had just created a new tool for assessing risk personality. This tool is called the Risk Type Compass. The Risk Type Compass focuses on people's disposition to risk and uncertainty, placing them into one of eight different risk types based on answers they gave to a series of online questions. We are delighted to announce that Psychological Consultancy have made this test available for listeners of this podcast free of charge. The free version will not produce the full report, but will instead produce a one-page report which shows their risk type. And if you want to upgrade to the full 10 to 12 page report, you can for a modest £25 sterling fee. That's about a little over $30. To get access to this free report and to take the test, go to our blog page by Googling the AlphaMind blog or visiting alphamindblog.blogspot.com. Then go to the 13th of July 2020 article, episode 49, the risk personality episode. There, you can see the link to take the test. There's a small registration process and then the test takes about 10 minutes to complete. Further down on the article, you will see our own brief descriptions of how each risk type applies to traders and risk professionals. You will also see an example of the risk type compass diagram. I have used the risk type compass tool extensively in my work with traders and investment professionals, as well as my work with managers and teams. And it has been really useful in helping my clients to understand themselves and for me to understand them as individuals in an objective sense. And when I use this tool with the help of the coaching, it helps people to sharpen their risk edge and improve their decision-making abilities. Before we start, we would like to thank our sponsor partner, the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA. The STA are one of the world's leading organizations for the advancement of technical analysis and the study of price action. Membership of the STA opens up a world of amazing educational programs, accredited diplomas, and provides access to talks, seminars, webinars, and regular newsletters and publications. You can apply to become a member of the STA by visiting their website, sta-uk.org. Their membership is open globally, not just for UK members. Also, if you are keen to learn about and improve your technical analysis skills, the STA provides an outstanding home study course written by some of the leading figures in the world of technical analysis. I would highly recommend this program, which has been put together based on decades of experience and know-how by experts who have been at the coalface of financial markets. Finally, before we start the podcast, why don't you check out the Alpha Mind Trader Performance Coaching Program? The program focuses on helping people develop and improve the key risk skills and psychological factors which contribute to trading performance mastery and helps people unleash the potential they have within them. This program makes use of our unique and powerful Human Alpha Performance Model, which helps illuminate the human aspects of the risk process and in turn allows people to make specific changes and adjustments in a process facilitated by the coach, which drives growth in risk capability and personal performance. This program has been delivered to people at many of the world's leading trading firms, including Bank of America Merrill Lynch, TD Securities, Balyasny Asset Management, Credit Suisse, National Australia Bank, Societe Generale, Danske Bank, SEB, Swedbank, Cargill's, Gazprom, Millennium Investments, Norges Bank Investment Management, Schroders Investment Management, Janus Henderson, Capula Investment Management, Caxton Associates, and many other leading firms. To know about the program, go to the Alpha Mind blog, where the link at the top of the page provides further details of the coaching program. Alternatively, email info@alpharcubed.com. That's the word alpha, the letter R, and the word cubed.com. Or DM us on Twitter at alphamind101 with your email address. Or check out this podcast episode links on our blog or on the iTunes or whichever service you use. Thank you very much. Now on with the podcast.
Well, welcome to this week's Alpha Mind podcast. We're delighted to have Jeff Tricky with us. We're going to be talking about risk psychology, behavior around decision making in the risk environment. There's a huge amount of material that Jeff has been involved with throughout his career, that much of which Steve has constantly talked to me about, things like the risk compass and all sorts of things, and just how important they are in helping us sort of fight this thing called markets. So without further ado, I guess I want to hand this over to Jeff. Perhaps, Jeff, you can just give us your background and give us a bit of your story.
Hello, my name's Jeff Tricky. I'm CEO at Psychological Consultancy Limited. It's a company that's been running for 28 years. We are a firm of chartered business psychologists. And, I think the main theme of what we do is always been around personality assessment. Our Psyche platform was the first in Europe. We were the first with that. We were the first introducing in the UK the five-factor model of personality assessment, which was Hogan as well. So we did that. It was a whole series of firsts, really, in our early years, because it was such a rapid change of technology. So, and the whole business of using personality assessments online involved a lot of issues about confidentiality and security and so on and so on and so on. So we had to embrace all those. And I think a lot of the things that we did, well, they obviously were pioneering efforts, really. And subsequently, we have applied that sort of approach just about at every level, and I should think just about in every industry, from heavy industry to the financial sector to power generation to sales to technical programming and so on. I mean, it's been a very interesting journey, and all of that time we have kept an edge, so that even now we are developing instruments based on all that experience, but with a very sound knowledge of psychometrics. So we're building, if you like, I would say it's kind of evolutionary rather than revolutionary what we do, but it's new. I mean, and we've just had a period where we've been locked down, as you know, and as when we dealt with the crisis in 2008, when we had a bit of a hiccup there, because of course a lot of our clients were struggling. We used that to put ideas together for how we would take things forward.
Okay, and the reason, I mean, I've known you for quite a few years, and the reason I became interested was because of a tool you developed called the Risk Type Compass. So perhaps you could tell our audience about that, because I'm sure that's the area where most of them are going to be interested in what it is you do.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that was something that was initiated really by financial regulation following the last financial crisis, when they began to ask financial intermediaries to assess their clients' propensity for risk-taking or their appetite for risk. And really, there wasn't, it wasn't really a way of doing it. What was happening was that people were putting together, people who had no prior experience in assessing people's individual differences within the banks, within the financial institution, were putting together plausible questionnaires, which were very transparent usually, like, do you like taking risk? And how much do you like taking risk? And do you ever take risk? Sort of questions. And we had a client at that time as described themselves as a wealth management company. And they asked us about this because they're none of them were very impressed by what was available to fulfill this new requirement of the regulators. They wanted something more substantial. They felt that it was like an imposition. We have to go through this ritual with our clients. We don't see the value of it. They don't see the value of it. It gets in the way of doing business. So what our response to that was, well, personality is full of themes which are about risk. I mean, you know, neuroticism, for example, is all about people being fearful and anxious and apprehensive and so on. So doesn't anybody use personality assessment? And the answer was not that they knew. And so we started looking into it. And we couldn't find any instruments at all that were focused specifically on people's risk appetite. So we researched the literature and we searched through the five-factor model, which we were very familiar with, and various versions of it. Not that we had the Hogan, we were very familiar with it, but there were other instruments around by that time as well. And there was quite a lot of literature about the five-factor model. So what we did was to get into the five-factor model and pull out every theme that in our judgment would have a bearing on risk-taking. And so we developed an instrument on the back of that. We wrote items for each of those themes. We gathered data, we factor analyzed it. And what came out of that was this extraordinary factor analysis, which was clearly four factors. We looked at it and said, gosh, a compass. This is incredible. And they were nice, clean factors. Two of those factors were clearly related to emotionality in some way. One was about being very emotional and one was about being very calm and so on. So, and the other two were more cognitive, if you like, because it was about, they were about being systematic and needing, people's need to know, people's need to understand what was going on versus those who didn't. So there was one of those factors we call prudent. These were people who need to know what's happening. And at the other end, there's a factor that was about people who loved excitement. And that was kind of the antithesis of the prudent. So we put all the numbers back in the pot and we developed two orthogonal scales. And they are orthogonal. And I think without appreciating what we'd done, we had replicated the findings of neuroscience. And what neuroscience says about decision making is that it evolves two systems in the brain. One of them is emotionality, which is kind of very primitive. It's something that's been a part of our constitution since, you know, way back in our ontology. And the other aspect was cognition. And that's about how you make sense of your world. So that's the framework for the risk type compass. So that if you place those two scales orthogonally, which they are statistically orthogonally, got a very, very low correlation, 0.0 something, and it creates the two spokes, if you like, of a compass. And the compass idea we carried through. So what we had created was a 360-degree spectrum, if you like, of risk dispositions, which covered all the different relationships between cognition and emotion. Okay, so that's what it did. And we began then to gather validation data on it. Well, the first thing we found was that it was incredibly reliable. I mean, the reliability coefficients of both of those scales were above 0.9, which in terms of personality assessment is really unusual. I don't know another test that gets to that level of reliability that's a personality questionnaire. So it was a very reliable measurement. And then we began to do other studies which showed us what it was we had. And so I won't go into the complexities of all of that, but what we did was to divide up the 360 degree spectrum into 8 risk types. But I mean, it's not a typology in the sense that Myers-Briggs is. It is a 360 degree spectrum. So my analogy for that is that the risk type compass labels are like numbers on a clock face. You know, time is continuous. But in order to make sense of it, you've got to break it down into something you can communicate. So in the same way, we broke down the 360 degree spectrum into these 8 risk types, and which is it. I mean, that's it's got its own inherent logic, really. And subsequently worked. We've gathered data from all kinds of sectors and got some really quite extraordinary findings in terms of its ability to differentiate. And if you look at different industries, we call them industrial fingerprints, really. So you go into engineering, or you go into air traffic control, or you go into auditing. They have a completely different sort of fingerprint in terms of the, the incidence of each risk type that you would find in those organizations. The most extraordinary was air traffic controllers, because air traffic controllers are kind of 90%, they're all over on one side of the compass. It's extraordinary. It's an area which is covered. If I go back to those two scales, they're people who are both very prudent in the sense that they don't like uncertainty at all, and they're also very calm, so they're completely unemotional. So at the most extreme, an air traffic controller is someone who's unemotionally systematic and organized. And if you get into it, that's the training trades on that. I mean, training to be an air traffic controller takes, I think, about 5 years, but it's all about procedures. There is nothing. Air traffic controllers don't make up decisions as they go.
Yeah, well, no, I think it's very interesting, Jeff, this skew, I suppose, this sort of industry or role skew that you get. Did you find, though, from the way that you captured data and opinion, was there any sense of any conscious bias or unconscious bias that would have pushed them that way anyway? And how did you filter?
It was just sheer numbers, and we subsequently repeated the same process. But what we were dealing with originally were people who were being recruited into air traffic controlling. So these people were self-selecting up to a point. I mean, right. So predominantly the people, well, that makes sense to me, because the last thing I would want to do was to be responsible for a jumbo jet with 400 happy holiday makers in it, in a stack of 5 or 6 other jumbo jets all waiting to land. And it's my responsibility. As I can't think of anything more horrendous. And I think probably, 75-80% of the population would feel the same way. I mean, the point about the job is that you need to be someone who, they're not, they'll keep me awake all night. I'd be thinking and worrying about it all the time, I think. Not that I'm normally a big worrier. I'm actually classified as an adventurous risk type. But even so, I mean, the idea of being responsible for that amount of life and death potentially is horrendous. So I think, yes, they were largely self-selecting. But I think that was another finding, really. I mean, I think one of the papers I wrote some time ago was about the idea that people actually, when you go through the recruitment process, that the person is finding you the right person for the job is a bit of a fantasy in a way, because it's people who find themselves to the job that appeals to them and that matches their nature, I think, very often. I don't know if that applies with trading, but I suspect it might. But certainly,
to some extent, yeah.
Yeah. But air traffic,
I think often people don't have the choice, It's sort of, I mean, I've found sort of throughout my career that there are people that are in trading that should never be in trading.
Right.
They should be doing and I guess been that's just been their direction, not necessarily from their own internal guidance, but just by the luck of the draw.
So
it's, I guess it's a bit like the air traffic controller that shouldn't be there. It's just faking it just to say that I'm not emotional and I'm very organized.
Yeah, no, it's interesting that, because the person that we deal with mostly in this is the person working for the air traffic controllers who control the North Atlantic, basically. And this guy is a very important, significant person within that recruitment process. He's actually not a typical air traffic controller. He is not of that ilk. I mean, so he's got himself, he's been in it, he's come out of it, and he's now managing it. So he's looking at it from another perspective now. But so he survived in the industry by not doing the thing that he went there to do. So his escape route was that way. I mean, there's a theory of risk or of organizational culture, which says that the people make the place, you know, that the culture of a place is made up by the characteristics of the people in that organization. And the, I mean, and the mechanism he describes is it's attraction, being attracted to the job, being then selected for the job, so filtered to that degree, and then attrition, being fed up with the job and leaving or being kicked out. So, and so that tends, that's the process that he argues, that Schneider, Schneider argues that the organizations get more and more homogeneous because their reputation goes before them. They therefore attract like-minded people. They select for those sorts of people, and the people that don't fit leave. So I think perhaps air traffic controllers is an extreme example of that. Because it's such an, well, it's an extreme job in a number of ways, isn't it? Number one, that it takes you 5 years to train. So, you know, if I were a young person, I would never have wanted to go into something that was going to take me 5 years to get there. That would have sounded, I would have been far too impatient for that. So that, I suppose, rules out rules out impatience, doesn't it, in air traffic controllers for a start.
Can I just jump in there? Because, you know, it's... I'm trying to put myself in the place of the audience sitting out there right now, who are probably curious about this, probably very interested about it, and then thinking, well, how does this apply to me and what I do as a trader or an investment professional, a fund manager, a retail trader? And this is all about risk personality. Now, I use the risk compass when I coach traders. I use it at the very beginning of the process to get a steer on their risk personality, to try and form a more objective understanding of who the person is in front of me. And I try to find out whether they're working in ways which are congruent to their personality. Now, this was something I spoke about. I was a guest on a podcast just last night for Maria, a lady by the name of Maria Jose Ramirez, who runs a podcast called Achieve Your Excellence. I'm just giving her a little plug there. Or it's also called Alcanza to Excelencia, because a lot of their podcasts are in Spanish.
So are you speaking Spanish, Steve? Did you do it in Spanish?
I wasn't. My Spanish is limited to hola. So it
okay.
So I don't know an awful lot of Spanish. But we had a great discussion, and she was asking me, what are some of the traits I meet in successful risk professionals,
right?
Traders and investors. And one of the key traits that I keep meeting is personality congruence. In other words, working in a way where you're true to your personality, working in a style where, if so, you know, I get asked often, is there a personality style which will make you a better trader? And, you know, clearly there's one if you want to go into air traffic control. You know, you need to have that, what we call on the risk compass, you know, that deliberate or close to that deliberate personality style, that sort of calm, composed, rational, you know, follow the rules, have a process, element, and that suits being air traffic controller. And as you say, you don't want an air traffic controller who's sitting there playing online poker on his other screen because he's, you know, he's attracted to excitement.
No.
You know, but in trading and investment, what I found is there is no one personality which is successful. That, you know, we've found extremely successful people in every single one of the eight personality categories of the risk compass. But what is more important is that they are working in a way which matches their risk personality. And that's what I call personality congruence.
Right.
And that's one of the key elements of success. So you could be the very wary, cautious type. As long as you're bringing your skills as that type of personality, you know, which is, and it's not really risk aversion. A lot of people mix that up, and I did that in the early stages. They're not risk averse. Ironically enough, they're very risk seeking when they're working in ways which suit their personality. And ironically enough, we find people who are what we would call a very adventurous type, who may be considered more risk tolerant, but if they're not working in ways that match their personality type, they actually become quite risk averse. So this is why I think this is so interesting and fascinating for me. And I'd love to hear your view on that.
No, I think your risk nature, I mean, I think it's very fundamental, really. I mean, risk, the amount of risk you take or don't take is very close to survival, isn't it? I mean, I think three things that really go together, aren't they? Risk forecasting, for example, and decision making. I think those three things are inseparable. They really are. I can't think of any of them existing without the other two, really. So I think you make decisions, and decisions are always about the future. So there's sort of an element of forecasting about what you're doing, isn't there? And it's about decision making as well. So that's whether you survive or not, ultimately, isn't it? If you take it right back to basics, the only reason you're here, Steve, is because everybody in a line of descent which goes back a few million years made the right decisions at the right time, and they survived long enough to have children. I mean, that's why you're here. So we all exist only because of the risk dispositions, or not, don't say that then, even just say the appropriate decisions made and realized by all our ancestors together, and that's why we're here. So I think what we've tapped into, not intentionally, but I think where we find ourselves is that we're dealing with a mechanisms of survival. It's very fundamental and central. So that's the first point I would make. And going back to your point now, I would say we do have different risk dispositions, which for a species is a tremendous advantage. We've got people who will go out there and pick a fight at the drop of a hat, and we've got people who will resist ferociously any kind of danger or exposure. So that's, as a group of people, It's like a great football team, isn't it? With a perfect, wonderful goalkeeper and the fabulous strikers at the other end and people who do everything else in between. That's what you need. And I think, you know, if you look at it in that way, I think the dominance of our species is because we've got this diverse range of dispositions. And between us, we are massive. Well, we're unbeatable. I mean, maybe to a worrying extent, we're unbeatable.
Well, I think I go back to natural systems. You know, I think this you dipped into there, Jeff. It's so significant for us to fundamental of being, just understand this stuff almost before we venture into whatever direction we choose to venture in. And many folk just don't understand that. And certainly the survival concept of variety is very, very necessary for survival. It's also very, very necessary for great teams. So, you know, if you've got a trading team, you don't want everyone to have the same risk profile. You do want a variety of strategy to keep yourself looking at opportunity in the market, because if it all goes pear-shaped and you've got the same risk on, then you're in trouble. And I think variety also sparks a greater level of curiosity. and seeing things in a different light. And I remember there was an exercise I did once at it was a compassionate conference of some sort where everyone was asked to sort of to think about the numbers, you know, 1 to 1,000. And then they were asked, well, what did you think about when you saw that? Some people thought about it as a spiral. Some people saw it as a ladder. Some people saw it as the number 1 and number 1,000 with some noise in between. When you start to understand that within the variety, we think we see, yeah, we have this opinion that everyone sees things in the same way. In reality is that we see and perceive things very, very differently. Mm. And there's strength in understanding that, particularly when building teams, particularly when building the concept of performance. And of course, I think as Steve said, I mean, the compass is fine, but from a trading perspective, we see people sitting everywhere on that compass. And perhaps if I was a trader listening to this and I'm thinking, well, you know, I'd like to sort of understand where I sit myself on that compass. Mm. You know, do I have a bias that perhaps is pointing in one way that I need to sort of refine what I'm doing to suit that bias? And would I perform better if I, you know, if I changed my behavior or looked at things through a different lens? Yeah. So that's a question really to you two. I'm a trader.
Yeah, sure.
Well, how do I do this?
I think the thing about risk disposition is that it's personality. I mean, I would say that's the first thing. I mean, it is a part of personality, and it's that's the character of it, if you want. And personality isn't something that choreographs everything you do. But it does have a pervasive influence. So that's the first thing I would say, is that your nature, it's part of your nature. And I think particularly risk disposition within the whole spectrum of personality is particularly to do with your nature and survival. So that is doesn't mean to say, though, that you don't have any flexibility. You doesn't mean to say you can't. The point is you need to know it, because it will have an impact. You know, I think the estimates about how many decisions you make a day are obviously very speculative, but people talk about tens of thousands of decisions you make every day. I'm waving my hands as I talk. I suppose I made a decision to do that. You know what I mean? So there's lots of decisions which are not very important, but you make them intuitively. And so I think the way that you make decisions is very, very crucial. But it doesn't mean to say that if you know what those tendencies are, that you can't manage them. I mean, every personality characteristic has both disadvantages as well as advantages. So doesn't matter what you are. You can be an extrovert. Well, then that's going to have disadvantages, because there'll be times when you come across as bombastic and you won't stop talking and so on. And you can be introvert, and that's got advantages and disadvantages. You're somebody who can work and concentrate on their own. They're independent. They don't need other people to talk to all the time. They can focus on what they're doing. But on the other hand, in social situations, it's an effort. But there's not very many people who can't overcome to some degree and manage those sorts of differences. We all do. It takes more effort from us. It might, if you're an introvert, the end of a day where you've been socializing, you're probably absolutely exhausted and can't wait to get home. If you're an extrovert, then you can go on doing that all the time, but you have your disadvantages too. So it's the same with risk types. You know, there are advantages in every way, and I can see within trading, because I don't know a lot about training except through you guys, really, and through acquaintance with Steve, knowledge of Steve and what he does. But there's a huge range of different kinds of activities, and I do know that some have a very specific plan, some are very knowledge based, some do a lot of research around whatever it is they're trading in, I understand. So they come at it from different perspectives, so it doesn't surprise me that they are very varied. I think one of the things that came out of one study that I was involved in, there was a guy at UCL who was doing some research into trading and using the risk type compass for that research. And what he found is that, yes, most of the traders were risk-taking, but there were elements that, for example, I think I'm right in saying it was being mistrustful. That even if they were, mistrustfulness normally goes with being risk averse in terms of overall personality. That would be the general correlation, that people low in risk taking would be mistrustful. They wouldn't trust other people either. But in his findings, and this may not be absolutely generalizable, but he found that most of the traders he was dealing with were risk takers, but they had these sort of anomalous elements that didn't kind of fit that pattern. So, and I think that mistrustfulness made sense to me. I mean, I could see that from what I knew about, the little I knew about trading, that made sense. The point would be that I don't like the idea of people using risk like compass to exclude people from jobs, because I think that is foolish. I think, yes, you need them. You need, you know, if you're going to employ somebody in a job which is very sensitive on the risk front, you know, very important that things were done in a particular way, then it ought to play a part in the process. But if you were employing people with a disposition that looked as if it was not going to be helpful, it would be very reassuring to know they were aware of that. And had they, and if they could show you that in a previous job, they had managed to do that job and keep it under control. Because I think it's about how you manage yourself. And because we can, and obviously it's much more difficult if you're very impulsive, and reining that in all of the time, I imagine it's going to be a big effort.
Before we continue with the podcast, a quick word about our podcast partner, the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA. The STA is an outstanding member-led organisation which promotes high-quality education, training and research on the discipline and practice of technical analysis. Membership of the STA opens up a multitude of educational programmes, including an excellent home study course and diploma programmes run at some of the world's leading academic institutions. Membership also brings you access to meetings, webinars, and live events with speakers from the world of trading and investment, and informative articles written by some of the leading figures in the world of technical analysis and financial markets, many of which are produced in their regular newsletter. To find out more about the STA, visit their website page, sta-uk.org, or Google Society of Technical Analysts. Now back to the podcast. That brings me to the story I wanted to share with you, which was about, you know, you talked about this guy, the guy who's likely to have a fight versus a guy who's likely to hold back. And I was coaching this trader who was an FX trader at a bank. And he just moved from the spot FX desk to the FX options desk. And his manager had asked, you know, could I work with him, because he wasn't, in his opinion, fulfilling his potential as a trader. He felt he had a lot of potential, but the results and the performance coming through weren't that great. And as I got to understand about him and learn how he was, I kind of noticed almost, like we say, an incongruence between his style and his approach and his personality. He was a very composed personality on the risk compass. And normally they make very good option traders. I find a lot of option traders are in that space. They're usually running complex portfolios, and they need to sort of be able to stand back and take quite a calm perspective on what's happening and make a good decision with all those different moving parts going on. And he'd come from the spot desk. Now, the spot traders, I find, are normally the opposite type. They're normally very intense characters or excitable characters. And that kind of plays to their strengths in a spot FX trading role, where you're making, you're quoting prices very quickly and you're making very fast choices in a very fast moving market. And you have to use almost a lot of your emotion to be able to make those very rapid, fast decisions. Now, he hadn't worked very well in that environment on the spot desk, which is why they moved him to the options desk. But he was still trying to trade like a spot trader. And, you know, I said to him, I'm a bit surprised you're using that approach as an options trader. And he said, well, that's how I learned to trade. But he was saying it wasn't working for him very well. So I tried to, you know, again, get him to look at his risk compass personality. and try and understand the different types of personality that he was. And he told me a story which had happened that day on his way to work. He was cycling into work. So, you know, he was a cyclist, and he was actually working in Australia. So he was working for an Australian bank. And he said that that morning he'd got into a bit of a tete-a-tete on the road with a white van. And he was going uphill on a single track lane, and his van was behind him, and he was getting really angry and started hooting him, trying to get him to move over. And when they got to the traffic lights and he stopped at the traffic lights, the driver of the van got out and he was looking to have a fight with him. And this guy, being very calm and composed, took his helmet off and said, "Look, this is crazy. You want to fight me just because I'm driving along on an uphill road and not getting out your way on a single track lane? That makes absolutely no sense at all." And the guy who kind of had his fists up, you know, from the van was kind of like, you know, ready to take him out. And he said, "Oh, if you want to take me out, it's fine if you want to do it, but I just want to warn you that I've got a black belt, you know, in karate, and it may not be the best move that you take today." And the guy got back in the van. Anyway, he told the story to the guys on the spot desk when he got back to work, and they were like, you know, this is what spot FX traders are like. They're all going, "Why didn't you punch the guy?" That's what we would have done. And that's what most spot traders would do. Like, they are that very intense type. And it's like, what's the point? You know, why? I'm not going to take his anger and allow it to become me. And I said, "Well, that's a perfect description of the different types. You are that calm and composed type. You don't get flustered easily by things happening to you. And the other types, you know, and in a sense, you were in the wrong job for you. You were never going to be a great spot trader." And I keep meeting guys like that. You know, you couldn't use your intensity in your work, but actually you've got the perfect personality, risk personality, for an options trader now. But now you've got to leave behind that spot FX style of trading and start learning how to be an options trader. And to me, you know, go and speak to guys who trade options and look at their style, because that's going to work for you. And he did that. And then suddenly he started making a lot more money.
I think, it's the sort of thing you see in football, isn't it? Where you get people who've been playing a particular position, and that, for what reason, the history, you don't know. But then someone discovers they're much better if you put them somewhere else on the pitch, if you see what I mean, where the requirements are very different. You know, it's like, I mean, different positions on the pitch are very different in their physical demands, aren't they? And also the attention and the detail of the attention, and also the kind of rush of energy that's required for you if you're, you know, flying up the wing.
Athletics, great example. Yeah. And I always say to people, it's, you know, if you try and think of wrist type as just as a metaphor, a little bit like an athlete. You know, if you were built powerfully, you know, you wouldn't want to train to be a marathon runner, because you're going to be at a huge disadvantage to all these long and wiry guys. They wouldn't want to train to be a sprinter, because they're going to be at a huge disadvantage to you. They're going to have to work twice as hard just to get to the same level as you. And I say the same with risk personality. You know, don't try and be what you're not. Try and be more of who you are.
I agree on the physical side, but from a mental perspective, you know, I think a lot of it's driven by mindset. I mean, I could wake up during a normal day and I might just be quiet. I might just be in a mood. I'm just quiet. You know, something's made me quiet, you know, bad sleep, whatever. But there are other days I may wake up and I'm just full of beans, ready to thump anybody. And so I don't think it's a stable state, you know, in terms of we must drift around on this compass.
You know, no, you don't actually. Somebody. No.
Is it very steady?
Yeah, it's remarkably steady. And when retest reliability is extremely high. I don't think it's that. I mean, I think the point is, there are a lot of things that influence your behavior. You don't want to get carried away with the idea that your risk type is going to always be the dominant factor in what you do. I mean, there are a lot of different things that might in effect, you know, how much sleep you've had, whether you've had a good night, what you were doing the night before, how much did you have to drink. I mean, or just the frustrations of that guy on his bike trying to get to work. I mean, he's going to arrive in a different disposition than if he didn't. So there's a lot of other things. I think the point about risk personality is not that it's always the way you are, but that it is absolutely persistent. I think that's the point. Other things will come and go, but your risk disposition won't. I think that's the point. I think so it may not be always the dominant thing that shows, and there are many other things that will influence it, your desires and your ambitions and your knowledge and your skills and so on, a lot of things influence behavior. But the point about this is it's a very pervasive and very persistent thing. It doesn't go away. You take it with you into every meeting, into every conversation, into every conflict, into every business deal. You take it with you. It is there. That is there. The other things come and go all the time. So I think that is the point. My argument is that personality writes your autobiography. Plan your day for you.
No, I agree. I understand completely where Mark's coming from there. But kind of what I say is it's much easier to be in the right frame of mind if you start off by working in a way that's congruent and comfortable for you. You know, if you're working true to your personality style. So, you know, I'm not the daring type. I'm probably close to that borderline prudent, wary type as a trader. And I had to find a way of working that worked for me in that style. Now, a lot of relative value traders or spread traders would be working in that way. Now, I coach traders from all types, and I've got guys who are daring, who is the complete opposite style. And those traders, they're very audacious. They're willing to go in on just a few data points, whereas someone like me would need a lot of evidence to go in on a trade. And if I go in on just a few data points, that's really just me, throwing a coin toss in the air. But for them, they're quite comfortable doing that because, you know, that is their way of doing it. And it suits them, and they can't do it the other way. And then once you're working within that way, actually it's easier to get into the right mindset because you're not fighting yourself at the starting point.
I think, you know, everybody controls the way they are, don't they? I mean, I don't think anybody actually acts their basic primitive self much of the time. I think all of the time you bear in mind other people's expectations, what's considered culturally acceptable, what's good manners, and we are very aware of the reputation that we have and how we want to be seen. And that's something that we've crafted out of the cultural expectations that are available. I mean, there's some ways of being that are just not acceptable and you mustn't be them. And I think, we all do that. I think these things, these somewhat basic characteristics sometimes come out when you're just under stress because you haven't got any reserves left to restrain the natural you. I think that's, or when you're very tired, or when you've had a drink. I mean, people know that you don't behave the same at a hen night or a stag night as you do at a funeral or a wedding. Don't we? I mean, we know how to behave and to modify and change our behavior. But when you look back, I'll tell you one of the things which I find really extraordinary, and it comes up again and again. And I had the conversation with someone the other day, and I can't remember who, but it came up again there. They made this point exactly, actually. I remember the conversation. If you ask people, how do they plan their holidays? Which is quite remarkable. I mean, we've done this in a lot of team sessions, one of the questions we ask people. And people can't believe how different other people are. There are some people who, I mean, this particular guy was telling me, because his wife was so different in this regard, so he planned their family holidays in absolute detail, because he was a very detailed person. That fitted his personality, his risk type. And everything he did in relation to that holiday was absolutely planned in absolute detail. All the timings, all the prices, what was available, he covered absolutely everything off. When his wife did it, they'd arrive at the hotel and they'd say, well, come and show you the room. And they showed them the room and say, well, there's five of us. Where's the other rooms? And she hadn't booked the other rooms, but she had booked. She did know the Wi-Fi number for the hotel and things like that. So her sort of planning had been. So he always insisted on doing it. And I think, and in my family, it's the reverse. I mean, I don't plan holidays. I don't plan holidays. I like just not knowing quite what's going to happen. I'm very happy to drive down to the coast and get on a ferry. And that's my autobiography. I mean, I've had holidays where I've just gone over for a week in Brittany and ended up in Barcelona, you know, because chasing the weather, got to Bordeaux, that wasn't very nice either, and move on. So, and in my life, there are many times when I haven't worried where I'll be sleeping tonight. I'll sleep in the car. I've had to sleep in the car, or, you know, that's my sort of approach. But that's not very good for a family, you see. I mean, like, you can't do that with a family. You know, we had three children, so.
Can I jump in there? Because that's the adventurous type. You are, I know your personality test results, it's the adventurous type. It's a fascinating thing, and this is really interesting on the team aspect, because I know you've got a team risk type compass module now, and you can talk about that in a second. But I once did, I analysed a trading team. And, you know, quite often leaders are the adventurous type. I've noticed that over the years. They make very good leaders and managers because, I don't know, maybe, you know, people trust them. It's almost like they look up to them. And I was leading this trading team at a bank. I was coaching them, and I did a team analysis of all four of their risk compasses. And I laid them out on the table for them all to see each other. Now, the head of the team was the adventurous type. And two other members of the team, one was the opposite, was the wary type. One was the near opposite. He was the intense type. And there was one other, which was to the right, who was the deliberate type. And we were all talking about how they run risk, how they manage risk. Now, this adventurous type didn't set any boundaries, you know, as the leader. And he kind of came and went as he wanted to. And the rest of the team really struggled with that because they wanted direction. They wanted to know where the limits were. They wanted to know what was needed from them. And he never gave them that. And as we were discussing this in the group, the manager suddenly got up and he went, I think I know what the problem here is in this team. It's me. He said, and now I can realize why they're always asking for boundaries and limits, because I see the world through my eyes. And now I can see the world through their eyes and understand more about what's needed from me. So it was a real eye-opener for me.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it was very honest of it.
Yeah, I think that's the team thing, isn't it? I think the first thing is know yourself. I mean, that's really the starting point, isn't it? But then the next point is to have a better appreciation of other people. So if we're doing team events, we'll start off with individual assessments and then look at the team as a whole, and they're always done in confidence, so we don't actually label everybody else, but people nearly always will volunteer their risk type in that sort of context. But I mean, what I think about the team thing is that, you know, if you've got a risk type and you've got a wary risk type, they see the world through such a different lens that they really can't believe the other is really like that. You know, they think, well, now come on, you're putting that on. That's not plausible. How could you possibly be like that? You know, like the holiday example, you know, like, you know, the person who throws, you know, a couple of garments into a bag and a toothbrush and sets off and says, no, let's go tonight. Let's go now. We could get down to the coast by it and we'll just see what works out. And the person who's planning a year ahead or more, they find it very hard to believe that the other really exists. So the second level, I think, in understanding risk and in a risk culture and in a team is that appreciation. And what it does is it turns the potential friction that can arise. You know, if you don't know somebody's always disagreeing with you because they're a different risk type, then that's very annoying. It's very irritating. So why are you always on my case? Whenever I make a suggestion, you always got to disagree with me. Why? And then once, so that's this, you know, that's the negative aspect, isn't it? But once you realize that it's, they really are like that, well, I can make that more personal than that. I mean, if you're a fast driver and you have a wife who's very anxious, then you get really irritated because she keeps sort of going, ooh, and ah, and and calling you out for, oh, dear, you nearly missed that, you know, sort of thing. But it's once you realize that's, really is their nature. It's not a competition. It's not trying to knock you off your pedestal as a driver, which you might see it as potentially, especially some male drivers. I suppose the male and females can be very competitive. Well, they can be very competitive drivers. And actually, it doesn't mean you're adventurous to become a competitive driver. That's another story. But what I'm trying to get at is differences in risk type can be dysfunctional when you don't know about them and understand them. But within a group, once you appreciate that, you understand, well, this is great. I mean, we've got this diversity here. So, you know, it might be a situation where you say, well, this is my view. I don't know, Steve, how you think about that because you're a more risk averse type. How does that read to you? So you're benefiting from the diversity of the group, which is kind of essential, because if everybody is the same, as I've said, you know, it's everybody agrees with each other. So if you've got everybody who's the same risk type, there's no dissension. Everyone here agrees. That's right. Absolutely fine. And they might just be out to be sort of fall off a cliff financially with their decision making, but there's no one to draw attention to that group think, which is, maybe if you've got this, is, you know, this, let me, if I'm sorry, I'm getting a bit beyond the original brief, but what I find amazing is that if you go to Canary Wharf, out of that underground station, train after train load after train load after train load from early in the morning, shed loads of people going on up the escalator into Canary Wharf, going to different meetings within this finance institution. Sometimes we're millions of dollars or hundreds of millions or whatever it is, maybe under discussion. No one knows who's what risk type. I think this is bonkers, you know, because why would you do that if you can? I mean, it's not a matter of anyone saying this is right or wrong, but it's just a matter of having an awareness that this particular group are all high risk takers. They go on like a house on fire. They love their team. They resist anybody joining it who doesn't share their mindset, is the terminology you were using earlier on. And they're a potential disaster. I mean, I can I quote you something from here? I just was reading this actually this afternoon, and there's a chapter in this book by Mervyn King, which is called, incidentally, for the audience, The End of Alchemy. But he's writing about the what happened in the financial disaster. And it goes on about, you know, what was happening with the Lehman Brothers and Fred Goodwin and all these various things and what was happening. But the end of that, it starts off in the paragraph saying the cause of the recent financial crisis. The last statement is, it is a story about deeper forces shaping the constraints that govern the actions of individuals. And that is the point. You know, I think that there are, the people behave in ways that are commensurate with their risk type. And if they make decisions on the grounds that everybody else is making a huge amount of money, I think, I mean, this, my, I'm not, you know, an economist nor a trader, but what seemed to fit the picture was the idea that everyone's making a lot of money. So you have to go along with it. Even if you're rather reluctant, you can't not do it, even if you're the CEO, because you're going to get the sack because you're not making as much money as everybody else if you don't go along with it. So you get this sort of decision-making process which is being swept along by the, you know, the general flow of things and the excitement of things one way or another. But it is an individual decision, ultimately, which is a recognition there. So I think that is the point. for my thoughts about the future in terms of finance, I mean, finance and risk in finance is always mathematical, it's algorithmic and so on. I mean, that's the approach. That's how we quantify uncertainty, by obscure and abstract levels of mathematics, which to most people are beyond their comprehension. And yet, you know, the reality is that you're quantifying something which is actually unknown. I mean, that's the other, one of the other topics in that book about things being radically uncertain. So Mervyn King talks about radical uncertainty, and that's, he's really candid in his most recent book, which is called Radical Uncertainty, but there are things you just cannot know. But it doesn't stop people writing algorithms and making predictions. It's a bit like the virus, isn't it? You know, where you get a computer generated prediction about how many people will die, and then everyone's thrown into lockdown, and it's supposed to be 200, I can't remember the numbers, but some of the early forecasts were completely way off the mark and had a very important impact on triggering the response. I'm not arguing, right, I think we'll know the rights and wrongs of the virus situation until long, when it's long gone. Maybe we can come back and look at it at that point and decide, you know, what was appropriate and what wasn't. And people were working in radical uncertainty in a way, but they're using mathematics to try to answer the problem. I know, I heard, well, this is now really kind of off piste, I think, a bit. Maybe I shouldn't be taking it into that domain. No, I won't take it into that. But let's come back.
Okay, just carry on, because this is interesting.
Well, yeah. So, well, within the virus and knowing what to do, you have to sympathise with the people who are making decisions and who we were demanding should make decisions. People who had no idea, and they had to go then to the experts, with the people who claim to have expertise, and try to make judgments on the basis of that, which was, you know, obviously very difficult for them to do. And I got the feeling in the UK that we were really just following public opinion. I mean, it's, as people began to complain about things, then the degree of regulation or the withdrawal of the regulation kind of trailed a little bit behind, which is kind of a fairly sensible thing to do. But the point is, there are many, many aspects of life where we have come to the conclusion that we should make predictions because that's what's happened in the financial world, where you actually can't. And it's happened in the, it happens in the medical world, but it's also happens in terms of national security and international relationships. There is a book written by a guy called Michael Mazar, I said, looking over here, which is called Rethinking Risk in National Security. And that's all about the dangers of trying to think that you can use maths to solve every risk issue that you face as a nation. And, you know, he's what Mervyn King says is, in some of these situations, you've got to say, what's going on here? You don't stop doing the maths and say, what is going on here? And that seems to me a very honest and realistic approach, which then allows people to express their views and their wisdom. And really, you're back with individuals. I mean, I think you might get to the point where you stop auditing numbers, but you start auditing people in your organization to say, so that you know where those, going back to my, you know, scenario about Canary Wharf, there are all these people entering it. They're all going to very important meetings. They're all making important decisions. Nobody knows who's what risk type. So you don't know what biases might be interfering with what. It seems to me not a bad idea that you actually take some notice of that and try to make sure that the teams you put together have got some semblance of balance in them. Or if they haven't, that you know what the bias is going to be with that particular group of people, because it's easily knowable. It's not hard to do.
So that, can I just jump in there? Because I'm really curious about what Mark's thinking right now, because I'm very familiar with this tool. You created the tool. I've used it for many years. Mark is less familiar and is probably a good person to ask on how this has impacted him, what his thoughts are regarding this particular, you know, the idea of risk personality, measuring it with a risk compass, and then how useful that is in improving decision-making.
Well, my position has always been to listen and observe people rather than to really look at an algorithm of telling me how people are behaving. I think that the human quality is super important. And I think that, you know, I remember someone once talking about coaches as being people that just carry around lots of bags of frogs and lots of little, you know, little gizmos that they bring to the table to, you know, let's do another test and let's see where that ends up and let's respond to that. And actually I'm much more interested in the pure personal side. And I was very, very interested in what you said about, you know, the need for variety in species that we often forget about. And actually that needs to know at the beginning as to where we sit. And of course, if risk compass is a reliable, as you say, way of determining that, then I think we should all need to know what that personality part of us is. As you say, personality writes our autobiography and is a fairly constant. And knowing that at an early age would be very, very useful, you know, that sort of, you know, a graduate age, if one was to steer oneself in a certain direction and knew that. Well, I guess it comes back to, well, how would someone get to know that? Do you need to actually go to a coach, or do you need to go to some sort of process online to determine that you sit in this certain structure and you're sort of there? And where you are isn't really going to shift. So it's been quite fascinating to understand that, and that there's a degree of permanency about that position that doesn't really change, no matter what your mindset or your mood is. It always comes back to having that same flavour of you.
Yeah, and why I think it's useful, sort of following up from what you've triggered something for me there, Mark, in what you just said. You know, why I think it's useful, and you made a good point earlier on about, you know, well, mindset is, you know, it's how you turn up to life,
really.
But then, you know, it's behind that is how you are, it is your personality, and you can't really control that and you can't really change that. But it's useful to know what your personality is, because we're not actually very self-aware. We're not good judges of how we are. And, you know, if one of the things I've done over the years is to ask people where they think they'll be on that risk compass. And it's extraordinary how few people really know themselves. And I was as guilty as that myself. You know, I didn't know where I would be on it. You know, finding out where I was actually quite enlightening. And it helped me, you know, we have this huge puzzle, which is our ability to make decisions in very uncertain environments. That's what we all do as traders. And knowing where you've got a slight edge and where you are perhaps at a disadvantage is really useful, because, you know, you're sitting at this giant poker table and there's situations where you have an edge because of how you are. And there's other situations where you shouldn't be sitting there, because you're just giving your money away in it to people who are better suited to that situation. So that's why it's really useful to know where you have the edge and where you don't. And that's why, to me, it's so valuable. And in a team situation, it's also useful to know, you know, who in your team is going to be the best person to turn to at this point in time facing this situation. Who do I want to trust? You know, and I've seen this in a really dramatic way with someone who built a quantitative trading system, you know, where this individual, I've analysed him, and he is of the daring type. You know, so he's really creative, and often, you know, we say the daring type make very good architects. You know, they're very creative; they see things other people don't see, quicker than anyone else, and they're audacious and they're willing to try things, which is kind of the classic architect. You know, what you want from an architect: someone who's willing to take a few risks. But he's not a builder. You know, an architect is not a builder. And the person who's built his system, the person who built his system was someone else. He said, here's my ideas. I can't build the system. I want you to now build it for me. And the person was a brilliant builder. He was the opposite type. He was the prudent type. He said, you give me the plans and I'll build it for you. And between the two of them, they built this most incredible system, going backwards and forwards, using each person's strengths in the best way possible. And the person who built it said, I really don't understand this. Can you explain it to me? So and they just built the most fantastic algorithmic trading system because they're using each person's opposite strengths.
I mean, in our organization, you can see this as well. I mean, one guy who is head of research here, and he has very distinctive risk type. Our programmers have very distinctive risk types and so on. I mean, once you're aware, I mean, here we're very open about it. As you said, we wear the T-shirts and we have the T-shirts. And so we're very open, and it just confirms things very, the day-to-day experiences confirm it. And so somebody, people who are very good at spreadsheets and numbers and logic and so on and so on, and are very objective and very calm, are so different from people who are very anxious or people who are very adventurous. So, it works in harmony, and it's helpful to know. And your expectations are more appropriate, if you see what I mean, in terms of everyday living. And I think, I mean, I'll give you an example of a bit of unintended marital guidance, which was, I was working with a guy in Australia who was gathering data for us in the early days, and he was a financial advisor. And I got to know him quite well. And one day I was on the phone to him. I said, how are you? You don't sound too good at the moment. So I said, it's my wife. So I asked him, well, what's the problem? He said, I really earn good money, and I want to buy a bigger house, and she won't do it. She wants to buy another bigger house. So I said, well, why don't you give her the mistype compass? Just see what you think. So he gave her the mistype compass, discovered that she was very risk averse, and it turned out that the reason she wouldn't buy another house was because he was a commission only sort of worker. I mean, he sold insurance and mortgages and whatever on commission. Didn't have a salary. So that was her grief, her beef. She's saying, well, you don't even have a salary. How can we have a bigger house, you know? But so actually getting to know that was the situation between them was very beneficial. So there you are.
I shall ask my wife to complete one this evening.
Yeah, do. Do you want to do that, Mark, if you want.
Well, as people would have heard, and I would have mentioned at the beginning, you know, I am going to put a printout of what the risk type compass looks like on the blog page. So if they Google out for my blog, you know, as they're listening to this, just as a reminder, they can see what the risk type compass looks like. And as and when that's ready, I can update that blog article and they can go and take the test as a one pager and decide whether they want to upgrade it. So whenever that's ready, I can change that. But just Mark's going to take us out in a second. But before they do, again, how can people find out about you?
From the website, I suppose, is the obvious answer, isn't it, to that? Psychologicalconsultancy.com. Oh, it's psychological-consultancy.com.
Okay, wonderful. Wonderful. And maybe, Mark, maybe I could just ask you to sort of wrap this up.
Of course, my word. Well, look, Jeff, been absolute pleasure. I mean, we are all the same, but we are all so very, very different. And actually knowing where we sit in a direction that, as you say, it's sort of fixed for life almost, you know, this sort of bias, as it were, is something that it sounds as though we can ill afford to be without, particularly as we're in this environment we're in at the moment, where performance and survival and thriving is all going to be increasingly important as we escape from COVID rather than escape from colds. But been fascinating. I wrote, you know, so many things. You know, people make the place. It's important to know that. It's important to know that from a survival, a natural system point of view, variety is pretty important. And if you've not got variety in a team where actually it'd be beneficial to have variety, and know that there's risk in not having variety, is also really, really important, particularly in areas like trading, where you make yourself a ticking time bomb because you've just not been paying attention to the fact that all your dice is just loaded in one direction. So many things, Jeff, and I'm sure the audience have taken lots of notes and lots of real advice as to the need to really self-manage comes out as quite important too as part of this process as we learn to thrive and survive in the new world. So with thanks again, Jeff, and we're happy to promote all your work through our blog and through this podcast. So many thanks indeed.
Thank you both. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. As a reminder, if you want to take the risk type compass test, Psychological Consultancy have done us a huge favour by making it available free of charge for our listeners. The free version will not produce the full report, but will instead produce a one-page report which shows your risk type. And if you want to upgrade to the full 10 to 12-page report, you can do so for a modest £25 UK sterling fee, which is just over $30. You can get this free report and take the test by going to our blog page, the alphamindblog.blogspot.com, or just Google the Alphamind blog and go to the 13th of July 2020 article, episode 49, the risk personality episode. There you will see the link to take the test, and further down on the article you will see our own brief descriptions of how each risk type applies to traders and risk professionals, and you will see a diagram of the risk type compass. Now, the test takes about 10 minutes to complete after you've done a short registration process. So once again, thank you to Jeff Tricky and Psychological Consultancy for allowing our listeners to take this test. Thank you for listening today. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you have been enjoying the Alphamind podcast series, we would be delighted if you could rate and review the show on iTunes or whichever podcast service you use. Ratings and reviews help us grow our audience, which in turn enables us to keep bringing you outstanding guests for your education and pleasure. Also, be sure to subscribe or follow the Alphamind podcast on whichever podcast service you use, so as to make sure you do not miss future episodes. Thank you to our podcast partner, the Society of Technical Analysts, the STA. You can learn more about their service, becoming a member, and their outstanding technical analysis home study course on the STA website, sta-uk.org. Alphamind is a joint collaboration between Mark Randall and myself, Stephen Goldstein. To know more about us, visit our website, alpha-mind.net, or go to the Alphamind blog, alphamindblog.blogspot.com. There you can subscribe to our new newsletter. You can also follow us on social media. My Twitter handle is at alphamind101, and Mark's Twitter handle is at alphamind102. Or connect with us on LinkedIn and join our Alphamind LinkedIn group. Thank you once again for listening, and we hope you have a great week.